Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today by Texas Politics Project Research Director Josh Blank. Here, wearing pants of a more conventional style.
Conventional pants, that's right.
Conventional pants. There was some pre-roll on that that we're not going to really bother to get into here, but, you know.
The hermeneutics.
We were talking about clothing before, right before coming on the air. So, for today's podcast, I thought we'd return to a theme or a way of framing the 2026 election or something, and that is... You know, this idea that Texas Republicans are going to have a lot of incentive to try to define the election in Texas terms as much as possible. And you know, we will arrive at a sub-theme of this in a way, and that is the comparison that people are making, and understandably so, between 2018 and 2026, or comparison is even not, doesn't even generally...
Right.
Describe, I think, what we're getting. A lot of like, you know, what can 2018 tell us
The instructiveness of 2018.
Yeah, what can it tell us and not tell us about 2026?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, and the idea here in terms of thinking about the, you know, the Texas, you know, the effort to turn this election at the statewide level more to Texas than to the national environment,
right.
You know, kind of obvious, right? I mean... You know, there is going to be a lot of efforts by pretty much anyone not named Tallarico to turn the attention in the election to something other than the economy and other than Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, so I think in particular one of the things that we've been thinking about and want to try to do here a little bit is that, you know, there's – this post-primary vibe right now, which I think we've all been waiting for. You know, I think in general, or from the outside in the non-operative world, shall we say, you know, the primary vibe in a lot of ways right now has been kind of trying to my mind, avoid not being stuck in that what color is Texas set of questions. And I think we saw some signs this week that those who are not caught up in that whirlpool and are more directly involved in races and in strategy, you know, are trying to figure out more concretely and more specifically, what is the situation in Texas with legislative races?
Right.
I mean, I think as everybody was focused, I think it's fair to say that as everybody was focused on the Senate race, the two primaries, then the runoff, this was kind of a secondary consideration. It was there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in you know, the now not relevant argument being made by Cornyn supporters and the Cornyn campaign that this would have, that that a Paxton candidacy would have a lot of, would have a lot of negative repercussions down ballot. We have to kind of bracket that. And, you know, there's an article floating around that somebody sent me to look at, an academic article on positing a lack of relationship between down ballot effects and top of the ticket. And I was, did I share that with you?
No, but that sounds plausible.
It's an AJPS thing.
Yeah.
You know, a reporter sent me to look at last week, friend of the podcast, and I just haven't gotten to, but
yeah, I mean,
you know, it, at first cut, sorry for the public answer, my friend.
Yeah.
It looked plausible, but I, you know, I need to look more closely and take more time with it that I haven't taken. But
yeah, a lot of academic questions to flow out of that.
Exactly.
Kind of,
I mean, there were some research design questions I had about it. But anyway. But, you know, there is, you know, this question is like, you know, what are the legislative races going to look like? And we've got a few new news tidbits this week that we can use to, as a point of departure. And
teed up a little bit.
You know, as we get this turn to the general election. So what do we got? You know, I think the first thing, I'll just name these two things and we'll unpack them.
Yeah,
so
sure.
First thing are these, you know, the Texas GOP candidate confab on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, that June 2nd or 3rd for archival purposes, at the Omni in Austin,
mm-hmm.
In which, and this was put on really by, at least per the reporting, the main sort of energy here was coming from the Abbott, the Greg Abbott's political team and Dustin Burrows, Speaker Dustin Burrows' political team,
yep.
reported in the newsletters and stuff, and we'll talk a little more about that. But then also, right on top of that, the announcement by the national organization, the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, the DLCC, which focuses on legislative races across the country,
mm-hmm.
Their announcement of targeted races in Texas, et cetera, et cetera. So,
right.
You know, let's start with the GOP candidate confab. And these things take place kind of every cycle.
Yeah.
One degree or another, right? And so this event was a strategy summit among Republican political consultants, lobbyists, pollsters, per the description in the Texas bullpen,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm assuming was reported by Brad Johnson. I think that's right. You know, and the warnings that came out of this followed a general pattern, right?
Right.
That we've been hearing a lot in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, and I think the sort of the takeaway, you know, was in some ways not news, but it depends on, you know, I think your context for these kinds of things. I mean, I don't know, and it'll be interesting to see what your reaction was. At least, again, this is our secondhand reaction to the reporting, so you kind of
take it
for what it is.
Word in the room.
Yeah, word in the room kind of thing. But I mean, the basic, you know, message was, okay, that's done with. You know, we're all on the same team now, and we got to be on the same message. And, you know, I think without exactly saying it all, I think they, I mean, some people said it. I mean, I'm not sure exactly if it was said in the room, but I think the message is, look, this isn't going to be an easy election cycle. I mean, they're not walking straight up to that. But I mean, to me, and I don't know.
And not the first we've heard. I mean, Patrick and Abbott.
Yeah.
We're sending signals like this for the last couple of months.
Right. And I think always, you know, you always have to take that sort of communication with the right amount of, you know, I don't know, the right amount of salt, right? Because in some sense,
how much of it is instrumental and how much of it is real?
Right, because there's always a reason.
There's a Venn diagram here, probably.
Yeah, because like just to like elaborate it, you know, look, if I'm a candidate and I'm going to go talk to donors and I say, yeah, no, I think I'm up 40, can I have a bunch of money? You're not going to give it to you. I mean, at the extreme, right? And so there is an incentive for candidates and campaigns, both for donors and to mobilize their voters to say, things like it's really close.
Create a sense of urgency.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how many times have you heard that this is the biggest election in your lifetime, right? So that's there. But this felt a little bit more sincere to me in terms of all the reporting and what I heard about it.
Well, there's a more apparent factual basis for all this.
There's an apparent factual basis for it. And there isn't as much, I would just say, you know, chest thumping about how, you know, Texas is going to remain the reddest state. And it's like, no, we got to circle the wagons. We got to work hard. We got to do
take nothing for granted.
Take nothing. Everybody's got a campaign. Don't sit this one and just think it's going to happen easily for you, because it's not that kind of cycle. And that to me, I think was a very, you know, I mean, it follows other versions of this, but it's a very open acknowledgement by the leadership in the state. And again, you know, the consultants are obviously going to do the same thing, right? You guys are in trouble. We can help you, right? So you have to take that with a certain amount of salt too. But the consistency of this, both over time, across the different actors, pretty much from everyone who's in a position to actually have to like raise the money and spend it, is notable in this cycle, I think.
Right. I mean, I think part of what's interesting about this moment and what we're kind of up to today and what we're up to generally in this
time frame,
kind of interim frame between the conclusion of the primaries and the time that the public really starts paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty long period, a little shorter this time because of the runoffs. But, you know, generally we're talking about a while of, you know, this kind of, you know, borderline, you know, trying to avoid thrashing in thinking about it. I mean, the broad thing to me right now that, you know, I think if you abstract out what we're spending a lot of time talking about and thinking about, it's, you know, pulling out the more specific characteristics of this election from the expected patterns.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, and the expected phenomena. So, you know, along the lines of the expected things, what you're talking about, a sense of urgency in order to mobilize not only donors, but in this room also candidate efforts.
Right.
And I think that's something that it's easy from the outside to forget, is that particularly as the parties become more polarized and we think, you know, we have simpler views of the parties because the parties are, ideologically speaking, all things equal, more homogenous. And again, both parties have internal fights, blah, blah, blah. But because of that, I think it's easier for probably the layperson to think, well, you know, the Republicans are going to do X and the Democrats are going to do Y, and they're both mobilizing their stuff. But they have collective action issues within the party, and that was part of what was going on here. So the typical things of this, I think, were, one, primary's over, and as the bullpen put it, you know, quote-unquote, Greg Abbott, and this is a little bit of a it's their paraphrase.
Yeah.
Governor Abbott and Dustin Speaker Burroughs and their advisors, Dave Carney and Jason Johnson, respectively, stressed the need for everybody in that room to get on the same page for the general election, regardless of how they felt about the U.S. Senate runoff.
Right.
Typical.
Yeah.
Primaries, if they're contested, are divisive. This was probably, you know, above the average line in its divisiveness and the visibility of that divisiveness. So that's pretty typical, as is, you know, the point you were making.
Yeah. And I think just to follow up on something you were saying here about not taking it for granted, I mean, one of the things that came out of that meeting was this notion that there's a relatively large $60 to $65 million shortfall in fundraising.
Right.
Now, again, to caveat, as people know, these are based on the requests that they are, you know, that the consultants are kind of fielding.
The people that are going to get a piece of this are making,
and it's also
saying they need.
Yeah, and it's also the case that there are campaigns who would say, like, hey, I'd like this, and they're going to say, yeah, you don't need that, right, or whatever. So this is, so just take this as an estimate, but it just is a reflection of the fact that a very well-resourced party is sort of raising its hand and saying, hey, we're probably going to need some more resources. Does someone like Greg Abbott have these resources? Yeah, I mean, these resources are floating around in the ecosystem. But to your point about, you know, sort of the, let's just say, I'm trying to think where I want to put it, but let's just say the Republican candidate who's representing an overwhelmingly rural conservative district.
Yeah.
That candidate may have faced a Democrat at some point in time in the last few cycles, but honestly, probably hasn't.
Right.
And one of the you know, sort of side, you know, one of the impacts of Democrats actually putting candidates
populating the ballot.
Is that, you know, it doesn't mean that these Democrats are going to go out in Midland or something and run up, you know, and do something that you don't expect. But, you know, based on just sort of a general look at the data, when you look at these rural counties, you're looking at about a 75-25 split for the Republican Party. And I think what the Democrats are not saying is, oh, we're going to go out and win all these rural Republican districts. But if they can make that a, you know, a 70-30 race instead of 75-25, if they can make it a 65-20, you know, five, they can duck it down to 60-40 or something, all of a sudden that accrues up the ticket, which is where the statewide question comes in. And so part of this is, yeah, you're going to win your race out there, but you need to run a campaign. You can't just hemorrhage votes to the other side because you're still going to win, because that's going to have a negative impact.
And there's an interesting arrows in, but, you know, reciprocity there, or, you know, feedback loop, arrows in both directions, whatever you want to.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, obviously the statewide candidates benefit from telling all these candidates that aren't used to working, frankly, or spending money to mobilize, hey, you need to mobilize this time.
Right.
You know, both for your own good. And that's, and that does go into where there's some tactical messaging here going on.
Right.
I mean, one of the specific bits of the anti-complacency warning that, you know, Team Abbott and Team Burroughs were issuing, that I, you know, you picked up on when I think when we were, you know, talking about this to begin with, and I think rightly, is this, you know, saying that anybody who's R in a district that's, you know, R plus 12 or lower, that is, that had a 12-point advantage, presumably in the last election.
Yeah, presumably.
I mean, it could be some other measure they're using, an Orvis or whatever, but, you know, that's the floor of being worried, and that's a, you know, it's a pretty high floor.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, so the reason that just stuck out to me is, and this has kind of been going on since the special election that we had in State Senate District 9, where we saw a swing from a Trump vote share, a Trump advantage in the district, to a Democrat winning that district. Again, special election, caveats, blah, blah, blah. You've heard before, can't overinterpret, but it was a 32-point swing. And what that raised was not the notion that, you know, all these seats are in play, but that there's some reasonable number, right? Some reasonable Republican advantage at which you'd say, oh, these seats are probably in play now. And what's interesting about hearing it from the Republican Party is they're telling you what they see the floor is of danger. And this is not, and I'll just say, like, you know, whereas I can kind of go and I have the data that we have, which is more statewide data. So we can't look at the district level stuff in the way that they can. They have a lot more data to look at. So they're not kind of, you know, licking their thumb, putting their finger in there and saying, yeah, plus 12. Like, they're looking at a lot of data and a lot of stuff we've talked about in this podcast in terms of, you know, Republican enthusiasm, turnout models, things like that. And to generate a list that seems realistic to them, because this is about real dollars and cents. Like, that number to me, you know, when they're talking about a $65 million shortfall and they're talking about, you know, being on the same message and the various ways in which especially the party leaders are going to distribute resources, like, this number is meaningful in terms of thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, because people go back and forth on what that R plus number should be when they're putting together
the hot lists
right. or threshold, you know, targets, prioritizing races. And to me, it's usually, you know, between 5 and 10.
Yeah.
10 is high. 5 has always struck me as kind of a little more reasonable if you're expecting all things to be.
Yeah, I mean, you almost say you put 10 in there because you want to see if you have a couple at like 6 and 7.
Right.
But not at 9. You know, I mean, to your point. I mean,
yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I've gone, you know, I mean, back and forth with people about this.
But just real quick, I mean, for the people who are listening to this, I mean, part of this is just, you know, think about all the redistricting talk that's going on with those. Part of this is that, look, there's just a realistic, you know, floor and ceiling for the parties in the districts as they're right. drawn. And so ultimately, you know, it is the case that, you know, you do have to sort of say, okay, there is an amount of swing that we might think is reasonable to make us look at those races.
Yeah.
And in some elections, you know, maybe it's 5.
Yeah.
But in an election like this, the party that's in power is saying, yeah, it's maybe closer to 12 is where we're paying attention to, because these, you know, based on our modeling, these right. are the seeds that might be in
And
danger.
It goes back to, you know, how high a wave are they expecting?
Right.
Right. And how much turnout problem are they expecting? And, you know, we know, and we've talked about this, we did a piece on it about these hovering, you know, sort of free-floating anxiety about turnout
right.
on the Republican side. Now, so let's look at it. So the other thing this week that I flagged right. at the outset that falls right out of this,
yeah.
in some ways just the flip
side.
So
the mirror, yeah.
Right. Is this announcement by the Democratic State Legislative Campaign Committee that, you know, of their targeted races in Texas. And if you, their website, if you go and Google them, has good stuff. But there was also a big takeout that was, I think an attention getter, got a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, clips, quotations by Kayla Goh in the Texas Tribune. That she broke this story and was credited as such in the various newsletters, and on that their slate included a total of 15 races, so
yeah.
targeting 12 Republican held seats to flip, and then 3 Democratic incumbents with narrow margins that are kind of, you know, we were talking about this going in, that are seats that are basically kind of the usual suspects.
Mm-hmm.
HD 41, which is going to be open because of the Guerra retirement. HD 70, Mihaela Plessa, and then HD 74, Eddie Morales Jr. Both of these have been close,
yeah,
relatively close wins for Democrats. Very close in the case of Plessa, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually just looked at this race for another call. It's like they were right. like 52, 48, 50, under 52.
Yeah,
they're very close narrows.
So that's, you know, 4.
Yeah, I got it. That's yeah, within
under,
five.
Under 5.
Within 5. Yeah.
So the Republican list, you know, is kind of a mixture, and it was just the way it was presented on the page. It's a mixture of, you know, both candidates that are showing up on most lists.
Right.
Like, you know, South Texas GOP reps like Denise Villalobos in 34, Jenny Lopez in 37.
Mm-hmm.
Angie Chen Button
always
perpetually on this
yeah,
list.
Sure.
A little less perpetually, but also more expected. You know, shows up Morgan Meyer in 108.
Mm-hmm.
And then open seats like those vacated by John Lujan, mm-hmm. just failed in a congressional primary. Congressional, right? Yeah.
Yep.
In HD 118, and then Tony Tinderholt seat. Tinderholt retired and is running for something else in HD 94. Now, for a sense of scale here, it's important.
Yeah.
If Dems were to sweep the 12 targets and hold on to their 3 endangered seats, that would bring the GOP majority to 1 seat, 76-74.
Right.
And I think, you know, the general expectation out there is you talk to people, and which is just a right now thumbnail golden mean, I think,
mm-hmm.
Is Democrats could, well, you know, gain 5 or 6,
yeah.
maybe 6 or 7, depending on who you talk to. And again, that's all very squishy at this point.
As it should be.
But that's what's in the ether.
Yeah.
You know. So, you know, we've kind of talked about this a little bit, but it does raise the issue of, you know, what is our baseline for competitiveness here? How do we figure that out? You know, we've gone around in a lot, and you were an early advocate of pointing out that, you know, 2024 is a bad baseline.
Yeah.
Became apparent pretty quickly that, if not immediately, that that was we knew it was an unusually good year for Republicans, mm-hmm. and had a some kind of, however we want to parse it out, and we've done it in here already, we have to revisit it, but, you know, some combination of Trump factor and Democrats in disarray in 2024 and the economy.
Biden was drugged.
Inflation. Yeah, jail. Don't even get me started on that.
Sorry.
Well, you know.
I know. I'm sorry. This is an aside.
You know, could we not just wait on that? You know, between the autopsy and then Jill Biden, it's like, you know, Democrats have a habit of just doing whatever they can to blunt their advantage, but I digress. You know, so
24, not a good year.
Yeah, 24 is going to overemphasize Republican strength. But the 2018 comparison is the one we're hearing more often.
Right.
Now, that skips like 2020 and 2022, particularly at the legislative level, 2022, where we had the new maps.
Mm-hmm.
Or a set of maps anyway. The first new maps.
Yeah.
I guess the legislative maps are the same. But anyway, that does raise the issue of what's going on in 2018 and how we should think about the 2018-2026 comparison.
Right.
Right. In other words, what is common and what's not? And we're working on compiling some data for another piece, so we'll not try to give away the whole story here.
Yeah.
But let's, you know, you dug some stuff out. I mean, there's the obvious structural contextual similarity between 2018 and 2026, which makes it not only an irresistible, but a legitimate comparison, right? You are comparing some similar structural circumstances, particularly Trump in the White House and the in-party, out-party dynamic.
Yeah.
Right, in that first midterm election.
Yeah.
In a president's term.
And then I think something, you know, to just sort of acknowledge here is that, you know, and that's all taking place within, you know, a relatively static but still changing backdrop, which is Texas itself, right? Which is what we've been talking about, demographic change.
Yeah.
You know, urbanization of the state, you know, the changes in the state economy and so on and so forth in ways that, you know, are just, they're going to keep going. We're going to see.
Right.
But that's why these sorts of, you know, the political context around these elections is valuable. And I think, you know, one point that you made, I hadn't really thought about this way, it's interesting, which is to say that, you know, there are people making this 2018 comparison point, but a lot of it is really to sort of focus it towards the Tallarico-Paxson matchup, which is, you know, yeah, very interesting. But as your point out, we're kind of interesting. Like, yeah, but how does this filter down
right.
everything
and the Tallarico-Beto comparison, right?
I mean,
which, again, on the surface of it is fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, candidate comes out, at least from the perspective of the national press, but even of Texas, kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Certainly from a national perspective. You know, has never run statewide, seems to be offering, you know, kind of breath of fresh air.
Yeah, which in and of itself, in some ways, you know, I just say not to like, you know, I'm just sort of thinking right now, but that also just reflects a lot of the fundamental dynamics here, which is, you know, yeah, Democrats don't have any statewide office holders.
Yeah, yeah. Most Democratic candidates are going to seem like they came out of the wilderness.
Because that's where
they all are.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay.
So you dug out a lot of data.
Yeah.
So the other, you know, I mean, I think, so where this points us is, you know, I think we have a little, those are all kind of very general,
yeah,
contextual kinds of things. I mean, there's a lot of data on the midterm dynamics, which is all everybody's familiar with. But we do have a lot of public opinion data that we can bring to bear. And you dug a lot of this out, and we've been kind of kicking it around. So let's start with the O'Rourke-Tallarico thing.
Yeah, let's do that. So, you know, what I've done for most of this work here is I've looked back at 2018. We ran three polls in 2018, in February, June, and October. So I'm using some combination of that data. I'm looking at the data overall, and then depending on what we're going to talk about among Republicans, independents, or Democrats, just to keep it relatively tight. And then we've done two polls so far this year, in February and April. So we're making, you know, pretty relatively apples-to-apples comparisons. In some points,
tentative at this point, but
it's meant to be tentative. We're at the beginning of 2026. On some points, I might point to the beginning of 2018. At some point, I might point to where we ended in 2018 in October to say, where do we end up compared to where we are now? So I'm just to say, I'm going to flow in and out of that a little bit, okay? So overall, you know, when we're looking at the O'Rourke-Tarallarico comparison, you know, what we tend to see is in a lot of ways, they're pretty similar. I mean, I don't want to overdo it in terms of in the public opinion responses. Beto in much of 2018 was actually a little bit underwater in terms of favorability ratings.
Overall,
he was underwater. You know, Republicans, you know, developed pretty negative views of him over the course of that year. In February, 21% had a negative view of him. In June, it was 43%. In October, it was 83%, which is what you'd expect, you know, of a campaign.
Right.
You know, for Tallarico, you know, he looks in a similar place. Among Republicans, 48% have a negative view of him in April. You know, for Beto in June, it was 43%. Okay, well, Tallarico kind of shot out of a gun a little bit. I mean, so I think that makes sense. When we look among Democrats, Beto in June, 73 favorable, 4 unfavorable. Tallarico, 72-7. So he's looking about, you know, to be on pace with Beto, maybe a little bit ahead of him overall. And then within the overall electorate, he's actually doing a little bit better than Beto was during most of that year.
Yeah.
Beto was underwater in all of our polling that year, negative 17 in February, negative 3 in June, negative 11 in October. So more unfavorable views and favorable views. Tallarico, by contrast, in February is plus 17 and plus 10, but with lower overall name recognition, right? And so that's
right.
The thing that's floating around out here. I think what's also notable here is that, you know, independents are going to come up a lot as we talk about the data. You know, when we look at where Beto was with independents in June of 2018, 27 had a favorable view, 24 unfavorable. We look at Tallarico in April, so we're close, 22 favorable, 24 unfavorable.
Yeah.
So this is all to say, you know, you can look at this as two different things. You can say, people who think Tallarico is this, you know, vastly different in terms of just the assessments we're seeing. I'm not talking about because he's different in terms of his makeup.
Yeah, his impact.
In terms of impact, where we stand right now, you know, he's looking to be about where Beto was, maybe a little bit better. And I think, you know, for people who are Tallarico supporters, that should probably make you happy. Beto came within 2.5 points. And, you know, Tallarico is looking to be raising even more money than Beto was raising. And it seems to be a little bit further ahead
right.
of him with the
I mean, I think our
right
next
now.
Poll is going to tell us,
it's gonna tell us a lot
about how much that pattern is going to hold or change.
Absolutely.
Or whatever.
I've got an empty column here.
But I think the big takeaway there is really like, look, these are pretty they're comparably positioned.
Right. I think that's right.
Right. I think, you know, when I looked at this, I was struck by how little difference there is.
It's really striking. I mean, it is and it isn't, right? I mean, you know, in some ways, Beto was like, there were a bunch of different little things that happened that, you know, he earned media in these sort of unique ways that I think compiled together. Whereas Tallarico has had a handful of just big moments, whether Joe Rogan or The View or Colbert, that have just kind of just, you know, given him a certain amount of rocket fuel. Now, I will say this, when I talk to people, I mean, one point I like to make is, you know, one qualitative difference there is that Tallarico has managed to generate the same kind of attention in some ways with like sort of fewer kind of but big notable moments. Whereas Beto was, I mean, to say it, you know, Beto was kind of known for being on the jumping on the tables and yelling.
Well,
and
I could be wrong.
You know,
I got to go back and but I think this is right. Beto also started his ascent into public awareness earlier.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily because he had declared to run, but when he and Will Hurd did their cross country trip, which got a lot of, you know, a bit of national press and it didn't, pardon me, didn't propel him, as you say, in the way that it propelled. But that was, I believe, spring or summer of 2017.
Yeah.
Right? So that was, you know, Beto was beginning to bubble under a bit earlier than Tallarico was.
Yeah. And I think Beto had the advantage in that, you know, Republicans weren't worried about him and they weren't really gaming out like he was a serious threat. And so in some ways during a lot of 2017, he had, I mean, again, Will Hurd, they could go on a road trip. You know?
Well, and I also think the other interesting thing here is that, you know, Tallarico's rise and reception, and also, I'm sure their strategy, at least to some degree, consciously, not consciously, semi-consciously, reflects the Beto experience.
Yeah, absolutely. No,
right.
I mean, they're like—
So that's the interesting thing, too, about, I mean, these comparisons are close enough in time that, you know, the Beto experience is endogenous to the Tallarico strategy.
No, and that's right. And I think to the extent that you've
and reception.
Seen the huge, the spend to to knock down Tallarico's numbers immediately after the primary is a reflection of the fact that they're not going to allow him to go out and define himself like they let Beto during that period.
And that's and the response part. I think it's okay. So then let's Cruz Paxton. Let's talk about what how that comparison tells us.
In my notes,
this is interesting.
Yeah, this is interesting. You know, in my notes, you know, because so this is interesting. So first of all, just to go back to 2018 for a second. You know, and there's a million articles that probably have some kind of headline or subhead that say something about Ted Cruz, blah blah blah. You know. The most hated man in fill in the blank, the Senate, the whatever.
Yeah, let's go back to the Texas Monthly article, and I won't name the author because I was publicly snotty about it at the time, probably too much so.
Mm-hmm.
That said, Ted Cruz is in real trouble. I'm going to fundraisers and banquets and events in Houston, and everybody says they hate Ted Cruz.
Right. And so there was this whole everybody hates Ted Cruz. Now look, Ted Cruz won and he's still in the Senate and he's, and I'll just say all intents and purposes, he's a presidential
contender. A lot of people hated Ted Cruz.
Yeah. And a lot of people hated Ted Cruz. So what I have in my notes here, looking at the Paxton 2026 and Cruz 2018 comparison, and my notes say about Paxton, just as disliked, not as well liked. That's kind of the summary here, to my mind, right? So when I look at overall, right?
Yeah.
We're looking at job approval now. You know, in February, Cruz was 40 approved, 41 disapproved, so minus one. June, 39, 41, so minus two. In October, with a lot of campaigning work, 47, 42, he ends at plus five. Where is Paxton right now? 34, 43, so minus nine. In February and in April, 34, 42, minus eight.
Right, and you have to look at those margins, and it's fair to say there's a little bit of a stress in these comparisons because the Attorney General's office is not as salient to people as the Senate office in terms of their job rating. But that's why I'm glad that you emphasize the margins, right? Net.
Yeah. So what explains that? Well, it's a couple things. And the main thing is, one, there's no difference between Democrats. If we look at June of 2018, Democrats towards Ted Cruz, nine approve, 74 disapprove. April of this year, looking at Paxton, 10 approved, 76 disapproved, statistically indistinguishable. Even independents actually are not super different. If we look to the election, right, independents, and that was a big part, I think, when we talk about, O'Rourke's ability to narrow that margin was his, he was the first candidate where we saw the independents on balance supporting the Democratic candidate in any of our polling up until that point. When we look at their approval of Cruz in October on the eve of the election, 26 approved, 47 disapproved. If we look at independents today in the April polling, 19 approve, 48 disapprove of Paxton. So again, pretty close, a little bit less positive, right? So 26 approve versus 19, but 47, 48 disapprove the same. Again, I said, just as disliked, not as well liked. Throughout that entire year, approval among Republicans for Ted Cruz in February, June, and October, 72, 74, and 87 going to the election, which is what you should expect.
Yeah.
For Paxton right now, in both February and April, he was 58 approve and 59 approve. Now, to your point, some of that has to do with things. Now, I'm going to push back on that a little bit. Let me ask you this question. Let me just throw this out there.
Two things about about the Paxton. Go ahead now. Let me just say that we also have to look at those. I really noticed that gap, but the same caveat applies to those that applied to our interpretation of the head-to-head matchups in that April poll. These Paxton job approval numbers almost certainly – well, we don't know. The question is, how much do they reflect the fact that at this point the primary was still unresolved? And we know that when we, what strikes me about the 58 and 59 approval of Paxton in February and April is that they're right there with the, 63% of Republicans who said that they would vote for him in the matchup versus Tallarico.
Yeah. There's that. I will say this, though, is that those numbers are pretty consistent for Paxton. He's usually, because of the salience, you usually have Trump, Abbott, and Cruz pretty high up there in terms of Republicans sort of having evaluations, having opinions. Cornyn obviously has much more mixed views, but not as high overall, but still up there. But then you've got people like Paxton, Patrick, who kind of fall in this 60%+ Republican approval range. And so I think there's that.
I think 58 and 59 is objectively kind of low for a Republican incumbent, even even in a more down ballot office. Well, don't get me wrong, but that's why I'll be curious to see what the June number looks like with the primary runoff resolved.
Well, to your point, the comparison point is the 72% of Democrats who have a favorable view of their candidate Tallarico right now.
Yeah, right.
Right. I mean, I'd also say, I mean, I'll just, and this is just something to put a pin in, think about for later. But I mean, the way that Paxton has used that office and the abilities that have been, you know, given to him by the legislature, I mean, it's in some ways, it's almost, it's not surprising to me because of just the structural factors, but like Paxton has the ability and probably creates a lot more news in the state that Republicans might be exposed to than Cruz does. You know, I mean, just in terms of his ability. I mean, right now, I mean, I was reading this morning, you know, for example, you know, there's 130 taxing entities or cities in Texas that can't like basically raise their taxes because they don't have an audit on the file. Right.
Right.
And
right.
like, and they're, and these are all Republican counties. These are Republican, you know, these are smaller Republican cities and entities.
Right.
But the thing is, for Ken Paxton running statewide, yeah, that's right. They haven't audited. They're not raising your property taxes. So, I mean, it's sort of an interesting thing. I mean, he's been so out front on so many issues right now. It's striking to me that he still sits here at this level.
Well, that's why I think June is really going to be,
we'll see.
You know, this is the one in particular, I think, that.
We'll see. I mean, again, I'm
just most interested, and I'm not saying it's going to move.
No, but, I'm interested, too. He's had a hard time breaking 65% overall, though.
You know, but I would also say, you know, but the other thing there is the independent numbers. I mean, you kind of, they're close. I mean, if you compare the April 26 to either the June or even the October, I think you used.
Yeah.
You know, they're in the ballpark.
They're
right?
pretty close, yeah.
But if you look at the three, if you look at Cruz in February, in June, in October, that June is kind of looks a little like, outlier is too strong a word, but maybe the floor. Mm-hmm. Among independents, and it does seem like in 2018, and you see this in a couple other places, which is why I kind of draw the connection, the overall pattern allowing for the fact that independents move more than partisans, you know, Cruz was in better shape than Paxton is.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting point.
Among independent, or, you know, based on where we are now. And again, this is where being in April and the runoff, you know, we really got to caveat this, but still.
No, but I mean, but I think that this is, I mean, you're right. The June poll is going to be a big one. We'll return to this. Don't worry.
Yeah.
But I mean, when Republicans are sitting here saying we're worried about enthusiasm, right? And I mean, when we've been on here, and we'll say, I'll just point out, you know, we've made the case that, you know, Paxton may have been the better mobilizer for Republican based voters. And there's a reason that that's a focus here. And we'll kind of,
but not without a trade off among non-Republicans.
Right. Exactly. And it also features the fact, look, and this is the other thing too. We can look at this and say, oh, you know, here he is with 59-15 job approval. Geez, that's a problem. But, you know, real quick, let me raise my hand. What was Cornyn's?
Right.
It was way worse. And so that's the other side to this, which is, you know, that so just it is what
it
is.
How much? Yeah. I mean, we, you know, I keep, you know, I think we went through this a little in the last podcast. I need, you know, I'm looking for the simplest formulation to say, you know, basically, you know, balancing the trade-offs between mobilization potential and persuasion potential.
Right.
That's it, I think, right?
Right.
That's how to summarize it.
Okay. So let's step up a little higher here, right?
Yeah, Trumpy. Let's look at the president.
Let's look at the president. So this is, you know, this is interesting. This is a couple things that are sort of hiding in plain sight, but we'll go through this real quick, okay?
Yeah.
So again, same comparison points here. If we look at Trump's overall job approval, first thing to note is that his net approval was never negative during 2018 in Texas. So he was 46 approved, 46 disapproved in February, 47, 43 in June, and 48, 45 in October. So far this year, he has been underwater in both polls, 45, 49 in February, 45, 50 in April. There's a couple different stories to just sort of unpack here. One that we can dispatch with really quickly is, you know, Democrat disapproval, you know, overwhelming. It looks like it did in October of election year. You know, in October of 2018, they were 6 approved, 91 disapproved. In April of this year, it's 791. The intensity is about the same too, just for what it's worth.
Yeah.
There are two sort of other things that go back to this whole kind of Republican mobilization, you know, potential challenge here. Or not even, I mean, just election challenge. One is independents, which we've already talked about, right? So in 2018, in general, independents in February had more approved of Trump than disapproved, 49-37, and then he went underwater, 43-45 in June, 39-43 in October. So underwater, but barely, right?
Yeah.
In February, among independents, 19% approved, 66% disapproved.
Yeah.
In April, it was 20-73.
Our true independents, you know, for now seem to have kind of had it with the president.
Yeah, I mean, and look, I mean, it can change, but I mean, that's a pretty decidedly...
They are independents.
Yeah, and that's a pretty decidedly negative tilt for independents. So that's a tough one. Now, the Republican numbers are very interesting, actually, because they look almost the same, but they're not, right? So So in 2018, at least 80% of Republicans approved of the Trump was doing the entire time, 83, 87, and 88 between February, June, and October. In 2026, it looks pretty similar, 81 and 82% approved. But real quick, if you go to October of 2018 and you break that down by intensity, in October 2018, on the eve of the election, 71% of Republicans said they approved strongly of the job that the president was doing, with another, depending on rounding you do, 17 or 18% saying they approved somewhat. In April of 2025, 57% of Republicans said they approved strongly, 32% approved somewhat. So that's a 14-point drop in the share of the Republicans who say they approved strongly of the job that the president is doing.
Right.
Now, if you don't mind, can I jump down to Abbott? Because this reflects
Please
a
do.
Little bit. Because, you know, one of the things we've been saying all along is that Abbott's a really good backstop for these legislative candidates, given all of his resources, and also given the fact that he has, in various ways, I think, you know, tried to navigate this national state dynamic that you're talking about, right? And what we see with Abbott here is a couple things that should be, you know, interestingly enough, largely troubling. I mean, nobody's really talking about this, and there's a lot of reasons, I think, because one, Abbott seems like one of the stronger Republicans in the state. He's the de facto leader of the party. He's overwhelmingly resourced. But if we just take a step back and just look at the numbers a little bit, it's kind of interesting. I'll start with Democrats because it's actually interesting. In June and October of 2018, 14 and 12% of Democrats approved of the job that Abbott was doing, 67% disapproved in both of those polls. So two-thirds of Democrats. In 2026, in both February and April, it's 80%.
Right.
So the share of Democrats disapproving of Abbott's job performance has increased significantly and substantially since that 2018 election.
So we should notice, too, I mean, you know, because we're just doing approve, disapprove, and maybe you're going to do this. Sorry if I'm jumping in.
Oh, it's okay.
But, I mean, what's happened is the people that were either neutral or don't know seem to have moved into the more clearly negative.
Exactly. Right. Now, with independents, the interesting thing is throughout 2018, Abbott was above water with independents. So even though independents were a large part of the discussion about why, you know, O'Rourke was able to close that gap with Cruz so much, Abbott was still doing well with independents in 2018. He was plus 18 in February, plus 5 in June, and plus 9 in October. In February and April of this year, he was minus 43 and minus 30. 62% of independents in February and 52% of independents in April disapproved. Now, as you're pointing out, lower sample sizes, smaller share of voters is going to bounce around a little bit. But the overall trend in both of these is kind of undeniable.
Yeah, but a consistent 20-point shift or 15 to 20-point shift in the direction is not bouncing.
Right. This is not bouncing. And then we look at Republicans, who, again, on the surface look pretty similar, you know, north of 80% approved, not as high as he was in October. In October, 89% of Republicans approved of the job he was doing in 2018. This year, you know, we're looking at 82% in February, 78% in April. But if we compare that October number to the April numbers, again, look at intensity. In October of 2018, on the eve of that election, 69% of Republicans approved strongly of the job that Abbott was doing, with 20% approving somewhat. Today, in April 25, it's 49%.
Yeah.
Who approved strongly, 30% somewhat. So that's a 20-point drop in the share of Republicans who approved strongly of the job that Abbott's doing. And so, again, under the surface there, it's a little bit more complicated. And then obviously, if you want me to just move on here to the next part of this.
Well, before let's go to the economy. And then,
yeah, okay.
Before you go to the economy, let me just actually.
Yeah, go, please.
I mean, just want to add, you know, I mean, the interesting thing, well, go to the economy because I kind of want to wind it up. So.
Okay.
So wind it up with the economy stuff.
So there's sort of, I guess, two more things to cover here. One is sort of in the same direction. One is a little more complicated. But the economy is actually, you know, the big thing here, right? I mean, we know this is the big thing because we know that voters are constantly telling us this is the most important problem.
It's
the big thing, right? So how do we compare it? So I'm just going to do a quick June 2018 to April 26 comparison. So about the same part, you know, we'll have another poll out soon and we can make an exact comparison. But about where were we, you know, at the beginning of summer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, national economic conditions. And I'm just going to tell you the percentage of Texans who say that these things are worse.
Yeah.
Okay. In June of 2018, 22% said the national economy was worse compared to the year ago. Today, it's 55%. The share of Republicans who said that was 6% in 2018. It's 29% today. The share of independents who said that in 2018 was 24%. Today, 74% say the national economy is worse off. Democrats, it was 38%. Today, it's 84%. Texas economy, same thing. 16% of Texans said that the Texas economy was worse compared to a year ago in June of 2018. In April of this year, it's 46%. Among Republicans, it went from 3% to 21%. Among independents, from 23 to 64. Among Democrats, from 26 to 72. And then last, personal economic conditions. So forget about, you know, these evaluations and partisanship and everything else. And this really narrows this down into your own situation. 20% of Texans in June of 2018 said that they personally were worse off compared to their year ago. April of this year, it's 39%. So that's almost doubled. 8% of Republicans in 2018, 24% today. So that's tripled.
Yeah, I think those Republican numbers are pretty concerning.
That's concerning. That's almost a quarter of Republicans say they're worse off compared to last year. 23% of independents said they were worse off compared to last year in June of 2018. Today, it's 56%. Democrats were 31% in 2018. Again, 56% today. So in general, there's about a majority of almost every of all the other political groups besides Republicans, but a significant increase even in the share of Republicans who are making these negative economic evaluations. And you know, in some ways, it's kind of a reminder, you know, that the economy wasn't really a big issue in the 2018 election.
No.
But as we talk about all the time, the economy is such a driving issue for voters.
And to the extent it was, it had the conventional kind of valence of being okay.
Yeah, it was relatively positive. I mean,
you know, where the economy was and, they pumped up the economy.
Look, 84% of Republicans in October of 2018 said the national economic conditions were better than last year. As of April of this year, it's 46% of Republicans.
Right.
That's a pretty big difference.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, look, if you have one in five Republicans, which is in the last poll, saying things are worse in the state mm-hmm. than they were a year ago, you know, we've had 21%. That's kind of a problem. And to kind of so tie it all together, yeah. I mean, look, I think what a lot of this data really does show in a way that's more clear than I've seen other places, honestly, is that, you know, it really clarifies this link between that we've been talking about for the last few weeks and came up today between, on one hand, a real Republican priority, even beyond the usual pattern of saying we have to shore up the mobilization of our base.
Right.
We got to shore up our base, and we got to make sure everyone's putting money into mobilization. And if we, you know, and donors, we need more money to do that. And it seems to me that part of the increased urgency of that does seem to be based on a recognition that as of now, and, you know, whether the Paxton thing makes this worse or not, we're just going to set aside. I mean, in a way, it's nice how this enables us to do that, I think, a little bit.
Yeah.
Particularly the economy numbers. That, you know, the chances of really pulling out a buffer from independent and or, you know, non-Republican voters, call them, is not going to be very big.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, to me, as we look at all these independent numbers in here, we look at where Democrats have not moved, both in terms of their own candidates, Republican incumbents, the economy. You know, there's not going to be a lot of persuasion going on in this election, it seems to me.
Well, and I think that's right. And I think one of the things that we can do now is say, okay,
at least for Republicans, you know, I mean,
right. And I think, and that's important. But one of the things about that actually plays into some degree into one of their strengths here. So we've gone through all this. And I think if you were to take all the pieces of data that we've looked at, for the most part, you'd say, oh, boy, you know, they're in trouble. You can understand why, you know, you can understand why this meeting was going on and why it mirrors sort of
why people are raising flags.
Right. But there is a couple things that I think I should point out here that are necessary to sort of caveat some of these expectations. So first of all, you know, while evaluations of Republican leadership overall and even among Republicans is showing a certain amount of, you know, I'm trying to think what the word is. I don't want to say erosion. I mean, that's not exactly.
It's just attrition.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's attrition. I mean, fatigue.
I mean, look, the Trump number,
I'm going to say fatigue is what I want to say, because I don't think they're not leaving, but there's a certain fatigue to governing and trying to govern as aggressively as the governing has been, both nationally and at the state level.
Yeah.
Okay. And so while there may be some...
I mean, look, they're not... One thing about this very executive branch-centric...
Right.
More statist approach to governing in the Republican Party is that it doesn't leave a lot of room to blame anybody else.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'll say, except for the Democrats.
I mean, other than the Democrats and, you know, but... But even that is kind of, you know, if you're in Texas, if you're running everything, it's kind of like.
Well, but, you know, I'm not. This is where I think negative partisanship is kind of.
It's important.
It's super important, right? So one of the questions we ask a lot, or we ask about favorability towards the parties, and we can look at this. And one of the interesting things, first of all, is, you know, we've been talking about the fact that the Democratic Party favorability has been a little bit underwhelming, you know, during much of the year. But honestly, when I went back and looked at February and June polling, and we look at Democratic views towards the Democratic Party, in February and June of 2018, 75 and 79% of Democrats had a favorable view of the Democratic Party. If we look at 2026, February and April, 79%, both polls. Yeah. And if we look at intensity, unchanged, exactly the same. What's interesting is that Republican attitudes towards the Republican Party have improved. So even though we are seeing this attrition, you know, fatigue, whatever you want to call it, in their evaluations of their leaders, we're not seeing in terms of the evaluation of the party overall. So in February of 2018, 70% of Republicans approved of had a favorable view of the Republican Party. In June, 68% of Republicans had a favorable view of the Republican Party. If we jump ahead to 2026, it's 84 and 82% in February and April. So it's actually gone up by, you know, about 12 to 15 points. And in addition to that, the intensity has increased. The only, right, all this other place where the intensity decreased, in June of 2018, 19% of Republicans had a very favorable view of the Republican Party. April of 26, it's 38%. So most of the increase in the Republican favorable numbers among Republicans is coming from Republicans having more intensely positive views of the Republican Party. And so just to say, even though you can look at all these numbers and say, boy, this is a bad year for Republicans. I mean, one of the things it speaks to in general is it's not as though Republicans are going to be flocking to the Democratic Party anytime soon.
Well, you know,
To the extent that, you know, governing is hard, and we've talked about this before, the governing that's gone on that's been the most controversial has been in the service of policy goals that most Republican voters would agree with, even if they don't agree with the methods. One other thing, just to caveat all the sort of if there's Democrats, they're saying, this is our year. You know, we go back and we can look at these state House seats. So I went back and looked and saw how many state House seats did Republicans win in 2016. So let's think about the 2018 election, by 12 points or fewer, that number. And then again, in 2024, how many seats did Republicans win by 12 points or fewer? And, you know, the numbers actually don't matter. I mean, I don't count them up here. It was nine in 2016 that they won by 12 points or fewer. And there were seven in 2024. So what first thing is, there are fewer of those seats, number one. Let's note that. Number two, what I can also do is take the data and look at how Donald Trump performed in those districts. Most of those districts that Republicans won by 12 or fewer, first of all, they lost them. They lost them to a lot of the people that we're talking about now. Vicky Goodwin, Julie Johnson actually is in there. Rosenthal won a seat that year.
Yeah.
But notably, of those nine seats, Trump only carried one. If we look at the seven seats that Republicans carried by 12 or less, Trump carried all of them. In 24.
Yeah.
Now, so it's the difference between Trump basically having somewhere between just under 40% in the district up to 51 in all of those seats versus, in this case, Trump having at least 50.25 all the way up to almost 55% in those districts. Now.
But that also raises that issue of how far off the line 2024 was at the presidential level.
It absolutely does. Yeah. But I think it also, it makes the point here that, you know, when you're thinking about swinginess of seats, you know, just to say that, you know, these seats, when we say like a plus 12 Republican district isn't, I mean, to your point, it isn't inherently in danger. You kind of have to look at all this other stuff to start to kind of classify. And I would actually say, you know, part of the big difference here was in 2018, we're at the end of the redistricting cycle.
Yeah.
Those seats were designed because of a massive Republican majority from the Tea Party wave. And so they're already less protected.
And what did the margins look like for those? You know, I mean, we have to look this up, but
for,
you know, what was a plus for the districts that were, you know, whatever, plus 12
to zero
Trump even plus 8 to 12 Trump in 2024. What was the Republican vote share in 2022?
Right. Yeah, no, we have to look at
that. In other words, to kind of get at that, you know, just how big was the, what's the gap?
Well, and this speaks to just something odd that I think is a kind of interesting way to, you know, wrap this up a little bit, which is, you know, whenever anybody goes and looks into this data, it's like, oh, so you mean the state House reps did better than Trump? And it's like, yeah. You know, it's like, oh, you mean John Cornyn did better than Trump? It's like, yeah, you know, it's like, and it's sort of this kind of open secret in some sense, which is that, you know, as Republicans have really fallen over themselves to demonstrate their fealty to the president during the primary cycle, and we're kind of saying, okay, but we're going to turn to the general, all these attitudes exist. It's also the case that, you know, electorally, Republicans in Texas have tended to just do better. I don't want to say on their own. That's not what I mean. But like they've done better of their own accord than Trump has in a lot of cases, which makes you wonder about following him. And this brings up something that you were kind of, I think, started with, and I, you know, think we should mention again, is that's why this summer is going to be so much about trial balloons. I mean, to your point, but like, what are the issues that, you know, we're going to see sort of pushed out there to sort of see what sticks in the face of overwhelming focus on the economy?
And my sense is that's going to be really focused on, you know, state as a, you know, state level achievements, policies. But even then, you know, there's some tricky things. I mean, look, because one thing that Republicans and particularly Governor Abbott have used in the past is a little bit trickier this time, and that is, and we talked about this a bit last week, well, the Texas economy, you know, we're doing our own thing, we're booming, whatever other mess is going out there, you know, and the national and state economic numbers, the Texas numbers are not appreciably better than the national numbers.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, among independents, you know, 64% say that the Texas economy was worse in April than it was a year ago. And in February and June of 2018, to go back at 20, it was like 14 and 23.
You know.
Right. And so it's a little bit of a, you know, there are more challenges in that space. I mean, it's a little harder to go, hey, we've got a Texas stock market and. Yeah. You know,
all these Fortune 500 companies are
Fortune
here.
Fortune 4, you know, but I think when there's nothing else going on in the economy and everything else seems fine, that's one thing. But when people are preoccupied with prices and cost of living, that's not as good a pitch. Bottom line, I mean, I think on that. But all right. Josh, thanks for being here.
Yeah, this was fun. I've been wanting to do this and look through this data a little bit more closely, and we've sort of like looked at it impressionistically and in piecemeal. Yeah. It was nice to put it all together. I mean, I think the one thing that I just do come away with this from is just to say as sort of a closeout is, you know, these 2018 comparisons are interesting, but it does raise this issue. To my mind, when I look at this, I say, yeah, you know, there's some ways in which I look at this and it points towards the Democrats being more competitive. There's some ways in which I'm a little bit less inclined to say that. But I will say the thing that really struck me in this overall was to see the decline in intensity of approval towards both Abbott and Trump among Republicans, while seeing an increase in favorability towards the party overall. Yeah. And that's in the intensity piece. And I think that's something that I'm probably going to look in a little bit more to see who are those people? Where is the intensity picked up? Because I think one of the things, you know, is sort of a thumbnail sketch of that describes a lot of this to me is that I think Trump has been very effective in delivering the policies that I think, you know, the party wants, but in a way that's probably more comfortable with the most committed base voters than sort of the less attached Republicans. And so in some ways, you know, you look at this election cycle and for Republicans, I mean, this kind of speaks to the meeting. Yeah, I mean, look, Democrats are doing what they're doing. They're going to turn out. That's happening. Independents are going to be tough. And this is where the trial balloons come out, all these other things to try to shift the thing. But the real piece for Republicans in some ways is like, do they make sure that, you know, their party members show up, and especially the lesser attached party members, for people like Ken Paxton.
Yeah. I mean, I think this, you know, looking at this really does, it sheds some, you know, it gives us some plot, put it this way, it gives us some plausible hypotheses to explain what's going on.
Yeah. And what we're going about to see.
And what we're seeing kind of happening.
Yeah.
You know, right. You know, we've seen happening, you know, since the runoff. And where we're going.
You know, my last question, you know, something just to look forward or to look to is I'm thinking, you know, we're thinking about those trial balloons and what kind of issues are put out to try to move attention away from the national economy. And one of the things that I'll be looking at is thinking, do those seem like trial balloons that are meant to, you know, mobilize Republicans, bring Republicans back into the fold who might be a little upset? Or are those trial balloons that are meant to sort of, let's just say, more traditionally pivot towards a competitive general election environment? Because that's going to tell us a lot about more about where the elites are thinking they need to work.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, we've seen a little of both already.
You're right.
Right. And so those are the kind of things we'll be watching. Okay. Thanks for being here. Thanks, as always, to our crew here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin doing summer service for us, which we appreciate. And of course, thanks to all you for listening. You'll find at least some of the data we've talked about and much, but also lots of other stuff at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And there'll probably be kind of a two-step here. We'll release a little bit of the data with on the page on our website with this podcast, and then sometime in the next few days, we'll reformat some of this comparison data and get that out in a post on the site that you can look for probably early next week. You never know. So thanks for listening, and stay tuned. We'll be back soon with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.